Hi, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and USA Today Network. I am Graham Couch for the Lansing State Journal, here with my colleague Chris Solari from the Detroit Free Press. And it is Friday morning, the day before Michigan State basketball hosts Ohio State on a senior day that may have a bunch of seniors introduced that aren't really seniors. So we'll talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about the wild week that was in terms of two games that, at least from a three quick takes perspective, were the worst two games of my life. Just bizarre finishes, not bizarre. I mean, but to have what happened at Iowa happen in a minute, and then the way that game flipped and the overwhelming offensive surge by Michigan State basketball at Nebraska was quite interesting. So we'll talk about all that. Chris, how you doing, man?
Well, I'm happy that someone else had to endure kind of what we had last night seeing the Minnesota Rutgers game. So they, kudos to the beat writers there that had to watch that unfurl in the last minute of that game.
Was that not the most likeliest karma for Rutgers that we've could have happened?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's unbelievable, but completely believable at the same time.
Yeah, no, and it enormous loss for those guys. It might keep them out of the end. It's funny.
Well, it shows that Steve Peichel had genuine concern, but,
yeah,
a quicker, more routine pace than Minnesota wouldn't have had as much time to prep, too. So,
and
quite frankly, they had the game won. Like, you can't.
If the Big Ten was not a player of the year thing, if the Big Ten was a MVP race, Mawat Mag would have a really good argument for Rutgers, because if you look at, they're 8-4 with him, with some really impressive wins, and they're in second place, the only team really challenging Purdue with any shot as of the time they beat Michigan State. He tears up his knee. They're 2-5 since, with a double-digit loss at home to Nebraska and a loss at Minnesota. So, I mean, he certainly, there are glue guys all over the Big Ten, but you see one with them.
Yeah, they survived that. They built that lead at the Michigan State game before he got hurt.
Yeah.
And really kind of survived that. And, you knew right when he got hurt. When you saw him go down, you knew it wasn't good. Yeah. His defensive presence really, I think, was what they missed most.
All right, so let's do 35, 40 minutes of Rutgers hoops, and we'll touch on Michigan State at the end.
Yes.
I think that's what everybody's here for. I don't want to backtrack too much because, it's the Friday before a game, and I think – but I do want to touch on the Iowa game and before we get to the Nebraska game, just because it was such a – I mean, it was just unlike anything I've covered. And I've covered some interesting and bizarre moments and rapid points and, I covered the freaking Mac for a while, man. Drink if you're drinking this morning, or whenever you're listening. But and weird things happen. But that was, and what was strange, I think, for all of us, Chris, that is, we were all writing these stories, and because we assumed Michigan State was going to win really very late into that final minute, we're paying attention, but we're also writing because you got sort of these deadlines for these runners, and I had to go back and really watch it again.
I did too.
To really understand how things had gone wrong. And it was interesting because in the post game, other than like the foul decision to foul up three, you knew things had gone wrong. You kind of knew what had gone wrong, but you didn't have a grasp of it enough to really ask pointed questions like, wait a sec, what this or this or this play here that, I just remember thinking, sitting there going, yeah, I don't really have an understanding of how this went wrong so fast.
And it's funny because, kind of the peek behind the curtain, when you have a game like that where teams up 15 points, 13 points in the last 2 minutes, by that point, you think the game's over. You start writing things as you believe them to be at that moment, with just filling in some numbers here and there. Then all of a sudden, Iowa hits one, then they hit two. And then you add in a little sentence, Iowa made a comeback, but Michigan State held on. And then it goes from there, and then all of a sudden the last minute happens, and nothing you wrote matters anymore because everything that happened in a 2-minute stretch was right. all that mattered. And right. I mean, quite frankly, it was, I'm with you. I mean, it was surreal watching them because, I mean, it was almost video game like how Iowa was hitting those shots, but there were defensive breakdowns that I think were uncharacteristic of Michigan State. And a couple of those shots were challenged and contested, but I mean, it, and then it basically the fact that they couldn't keep Iowa's off the offensive glass, particularly Tony Perkins, he got 2 putbacks in overtime that were that basically the game.
Yeah. And that was partly Tyson Walker. I mean, that was what, you know, Perkins' yeah. quote was, you know, I mean, so that was interesting too. Cause one of the things I did in that was I wanted to sort of show the shared blame. So I went back and sort of looked at each mistake. And even Walker, who was so good in so many ways in that game, you know, had Tony Perkins saying, you know, telling a teammate, just, you know, go ahead and drive. I'll be there. This guy hasn't been cutting me out all game. And, you know, I do think what was interesting about that game is obviously it wasn't a traditional collapse in the way that you see 4 turnovers, 5 missed free throws.
Yeah.
They made most of their free throws except for one. They
you feel bad for AJ Hogarth because he did everything in his power at that point to get them the win. And
yeah,
one missed free throw ends up being critical.
The other team just hit 5 threes in 40 seconds. Now, they were not all that well defended, some of them, and there were issues there. And so Michigan State played its part in this. There's no doubt about it. But the other thing
it allowed Iowa to take them out of their defensive game and focus solely on offense at some point.
So the other thing, though, was, and I think this was important and plays over into the Nebraska game, is for 38 minutes, though, Michigan State offensively was the best it's been all season. Now, it was some of that's making shots, but they were making them at a great clip, and they look crisp. And when you go 11 for 13 for 3, that's about as efficient as you'll get. That's not a lot of threes taken. That's a lot of threes made. They were hitting, you know, from everywhere. They were really, really good on offense. And I know Iowa plays a small role in that. But what was interesting is it wasn't just this flash in the pan. They had scored 80 against Indiana, and the thought was there, well, it's a feel-good home game. It's the first game back since the shooting on campus, and there's a lot of emotion. They played well. That was to be expected. That stuff happens. It's not totally real. Then they score a ton at Iowa, and it's like, well, that's not, you know, it's Iowa. Iowa scores a lot of points at home. You
gotta defense optional.
Yep. But then Nebraska is a little bit better defensive club. And the second half, they score 54 points. And you see 2 straight second halves of more than 50 points. And you see a different level of oomph offensively than they've had all year. 3 straight games at 80 after not reaching 80 in Big Ten play the whole way and barely reaching 70 in Big Ten play. And so I think that is what's notable here is that there is something changing about them. It's not really all that much pace, but I think the one thing that we're seeing is part of it is Jaden Akins becoming a scorer, giving them another score. It becomes a little too much for teams to deal with when it's Walker, it's Hogard, it's Walker, and it's Hauser, sorry, and now Akins shooting from outside. It's too much, and Hall hit a couple in that Nebraska game. What was interesting about the Nebraska game is I think how many people's I mean, and justifiably so, how many people had sort of thought this team was just, I don't want to say giving up, that's not the wrong word, but they had sort of, it was a character check moment. They were failing, certainly. And
yeah.
And it was going to ruin.
And it didn't seem like, I mean, you've gotten off the mat so many times, like Tom Izzo said, when you have something that's so demoralizing like that, regardless of how it transpired, even though you played 38 great minutes of basketball and defensively you disappeared for the next 7, you know, that's still that can affect the team's psyche. And you know, you got to give a lot of credit to those veteran leaders, because I mean they came out flat. I mean, not only flat, but they weren't hitting shots. And that's what I think what's changed really since back to that Rutgers game. I mean, quite honestly, you know, they scored 55 points at the Garden. They weren't shooting the ball well. I mean, it was one of the worst shooting games. And they've followed that since then with a 44% game against Maryland, a nearly 46% game against Ohio State, a 47.5% game against Michigan. So they've been shooting the ball really well in those games. And, you know, that's why when you saw that early start where they had 10 points in the first 10 minutes at Nebraska, you started to think in those moments, you're like, oh boy, maybe this team won't get off the mat. But you got to give those veteran leaders a lot of credit, because quite honestly, I mean, once they started seeing their shots fall, then the defense came in, and everything kind of, they looked like a complete team. Like yeah. For the last 20 to 25 minutes of that game, they looked about as complete as they had in a while.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, I think there was what looked like a lack of leadership in the first half, but they found it in time. And you could just tell, even when they were still down 10 with 14 minutes to go, they were playing different. Hogard had went from having a miserable half to having an unbelievable half with 10 assists in one half. And then, you know, the defense wasn't amazing, but Nebraska was at home hitting shots, but the layup line stopped at the rim. And that was the big thing that changed. And they hit big threes, and they just, what they did, they overwhelmed a team offensively. And we have not seen this team do that. We've seen them do it on the other end. They, like when they beat Ohio State on the road, their last double digit road win, that was I remember Chris Holtmann just saying, I can't remember if he said it was suffocating or whatever it was, but it was, he just said that defense was too much, basically. And they couldn't figure a way around it, and they were impatient with it. And then this time it was off. And I think that's important, because you got to be able to do anything in March. You have to be able to beat teams in different ways. And you have to have enough guys rolling to you know, the old adage is three guys rolling, so to speak. And when you have Jaden Akins playing the way he is offensively, it gives you a greater chance on a given night to have that, to really have that extra guy. And I think that changes them. And especially for a team that doesn't get a lot of easy buckets at the rim, to have one more guy who's capable of giving you some punch up near 20 points, 15, 20 points as a shooter, because you're relying on jump shots, is important. And again, we'll see whether it carries over. And
I think it's important too to kind of point out that, I mean, there were some similarities in that Nebraska game too, where, you know, with about 4 minutes left, they're up seven. How are you gonna be able to close out? And Tyson Walker went on basically a, you know, 7-point run himself to close that game out in a little minute and a half span. And, you know, that was a big moment, because, you know, they were all of a sudden up double digits with 2 minutes left, and then defensively they did the job they needed to against Nebraska that they didn't do against Iowa. Kind of helps that Iowa didn't, you know, that Nebraska didn't have that unconscious shooting streak, but which
and they were, well, the other
you
thing
may never see again just, like that.
They got just far enough up against Nebraska that they didn't against Iowa, just kind of that 3-4 more points that it wasn't the foul parade either. You know, it wasn't that long. It just sort of played out, and they had really taken control.
It was only 1-point difference at the 2-minute mark.
Yeah, you're right.
Walker hits a three, and they're up 14 with 2:02 to go, and they were up 13 with 2:03 to go when he hit the two of the three free throws. That Iowa game, I mean, if he hit three of the four free throws, if he hits the other technical free throw from the McCaffrey technical, that, you know, it's the Hogard miss at the end was a moot point. I mean, you're right though, that Iowa game, there wasn't a singular culprit that was the problem in that. And I think the defense was the biggest culprit, if anything. And so that's a collective. But just as much, this was a collective effort down the stretch to put this game away, even with Walker getting that big run.
Well, and also Iowa had that sort of a heat check three that cut it to like seven at one point. Like if that sort of play doesn't go in, you stop fouling. You're like, okay, we're losing. And so when it does, and Nebraska didn't get that sort of shot, which is important, and then the ref didn't call the tech on Fran.
Well, I got to ask you about that, because I do think, I mean, we obviously have since seen the stare down with Kelly Pfeiffer that McCaffrey has, but I mean, it's clearly, we saw this a couple years ago at Iowa when they came out of halftime flat and McCaffrey immediately calls a timeout and just goes after a ref and gets a technical. If you're an opposing coach, don't you have to game plan for that? Because that's a momentum thing. And I think McCaffrey keeps that in his back pocket to get the crowd into it, get his team back into it. And quite honestly, in those last 2 minutes, if they were going to get back into it, that was, he felt, the only way to do it.
I think
it wasn't really a demonstrative technical at first.
I think he was giving up, though. I think he already had a tech. I think he was doing he was doing it to try to.
Oh, I'm talking about the initial part of it.
Oh, yeah.
You basically have to plan for Fran to have a technical that's going to incite the crowd at some point.
Sure. There's a science to it, and it works even it's sometimes, at least. Although, you know, for years they called it the Fran fave in February for a reason. But I think he should have been kicked out with the second tee for showing up the ref. And then MSU probably.
But I think the refs also kind of think you're not going to do this because we're not going to kick you out for a momentum swing. You know what I mean? Right. You want to be kicked out until you actually do something beyond. I don't know. I'd be fascinated to hear Kelly Pfeiffer, kind of break that down.
But here's the thing:
why he didn't kick him out.
Kelly Pfeiffer is not like, he's a ref you can't really talk to a lot, or he hasn't in his career. He's been quick with tees. He's not a guy you traditionally get away with that against. And that's why it was sort of interesting. And so if he just calls that tech there, yes, Iowa did amazing things to win that game. Michigan State made some real errors to lose it. However, if he calls that tech there, Michigan State wins by 12. And our whole discussion is different. They may have beaten Nebraska earlier better. They may have a three-game winning streak right now that people are going, huh. They may be pretty much set in the double bye as long as they beat Ohio State. And let's talk about that a little bit too, because obviously that could change this weekend. But at least the timing of our podcast versus when all the other games are, Sunday versus MSU Saturday, allows that storyline to live a little longer.
Yeah.
It takes a lot. It takes a lot for Michigan State to get a double bye at this point because they don't have the Minnesota game. However, the one thing in terms of figuring it out is they also don't have a single tiebreaker because they're either a half game behind or a half game above, which is wonderful for people like us not to have to figure that stuff out.
Although, and you were a little late, Tom Izzo still hasn't heard from the Big Ten that that's how they're going to do it with win percentage. I mean, it makes sense because that's what they've done during the COVID year. So, but I mean, you would think that, he's got a point here. You know, it's the Thursday before the last regular season game, and you don't know how you're going to be seeded if it's going to be based on win percentage.
It's got to be win percentage.
It speaks to the larger issue of what he was complaining about in the first place about not having any communication from the Big Ten office on these things.
Yeah, I mean, there should be communication, but it should also be assumed. Like, win percentage is a pretty standard way of separating teams, and is in every sport everywhere pretty much, unless you have points, and they don't have points in the sport.
What if you just took out everybody's wins over Minnesota?
Yeah, well, that would be a fair way of doing it. Yeah, Michigan State might be the one seed, Big Ten champs.
Stop right there, Rutgers.
So when I framed this up in the quick takes the other night, there were a lot of things that had to happen for MSU to wind up as a top four seed double bye. And it was, but one of them, a couple things last night started them on their way. And one of those was the Rutgers loss to Minnesota was not something I factored in. And now,
I seriously turned that game off with a minute left.
Yeah.
That was flipping back and forth between that and Michigan. And Michigan had just gone to overtime. And they were up 10 with a minute left, and they were going back to the free throw line. And I'm like, flip back to the Michigan game. Then all of a sudden I started seeing reports. I finally saw that they won. And I'm like, what? Like that graphic can't be right. I go back. It's talking about going back and watching an ending and a collapse. That was a collapse. That was an utter, if you want to talk about what a meltdown is or isn't.
Yeah. That was it.
That was a complete meltdown. Michigan State had a meltdown with defensive issues at the end, but that was a total and complete meltdown by Rutgers in that game against Minnesota.
So there are so Maryland also losing at Ohio State was a big one. So basically, and props to Kyle Austin, I wrote about it. Kyle Austin laid it out in this tweet pretty well. Three of these four need to happen on Sunday. Michigan State obviously needs to beat Ohio State. Nebraska beat Iowa, which is the least likely. Penn State beats Maryland. Penn State's playing well again. That's a toss-up game. Purdue beats Illinois. you know, that probably more than not more likely to happen than not, although, you know, you never know.
Purdue has nothing left to play for at this point other than
Illinois,
I don't think they're a one seed anymore, you know.
But they could still get there.
If they have a run in the tournament.
There's something to play for, because you're right. They beat Illinois, and then they win the Big Ten tournament.
That's a real big win if they do win that.
And, right, you don't even have to win the Big Ten tournament, because the Big Ten doesn't – the Sunday game doesn't count for the NCAA tournament. Yeah. So you take it to the final. Rutgers and then has to beat Northwestern. That is maybe as unlikely as anything right now, although that's a home game. And, you know, it'll be senior day, and they'll have some juice. So
the rack is a tough place to play, a really tough place to play.
They need three of those to happen. And
I think Nebraska beating Iowa to me is the one where you're just kind of like, I don't see that happening.
Right, but they don't need all of them, so they need three of them.
That's true.
Michigan State could absolutely still be in play, what seemed very unlikely the other day, which again, karma would, you know, for not getting that game moved and getting an opportunity to have it, I think would be
of course the other side of that is that could have been Michigan State taking that L.
What's that? What do you mean? Oh, Minnesota.
If
that
they
night?
Played, yeah, Minnesota. But, I mean,
that was going to be in Breslin.
I don't think so either. I mean, especially because Michigan State had already experienced that in the last minute or two.
Well, and that game was in Minneapolis. This would have been in Breslin. True. That would have been a significant.
Although I've never seen the barn so empty. I've never seen Williams Arena was as dead as I've ever seen it. So I found interesting in those last couple minutes that I was watching before I turned it off with a minute left. It was like they have no energy in that building, which is usually a really loud environment with. And I'm like, how do they even summon this up? And, you know, that might even be more impressive to me than what Iowa did against Michigan State.
So let's talk a little bit about this Michigan State team's, you know, what we've seen and how it could potentially change who they are moving forward, regardless of, you know, seed here. And I do think there's still a chance at a six seed for Michigan State if they can beat Ohio State and you know, not lose right away in the Big Ten tournament. They, you know, Michigan State, people pointed out to me, and they're right, has traditionally been a seed worse than we think.
True.
You
basically don't want to be an 8-9. I mean, that's what you don't want.
But I also think a 6 would be pretty ideal. And if you could, because then you're not even facing a 1, even though the 1s aren't great this year, but a 1 until, you know, later on, all the way in the Elite Eight, if you can become a 6. Obviously, you got to beat the 11, which they could lose to based on things we've seen as well. But I do think there's still a chance to get to a 6 if they beat Ohio State and win a game against a decent opponent at the Big Ten tournament on that Thursday, which will still, let's say they're still playing that Thursday or that Friday. Maybe it win both. They're not going to have to go that far to get to just a 6. Because people forget the Iowa game is frustrating as it was for people. They weren't expected to win that. That was a bad loss for the opportunity that was lost. Like, yes. If they win that game, that's a huge road win. Nobody else in the Big Ten has that road win since December. Been 7 straight going into that game. Iowa had won at home. And that would have, I think, you know, that would have firmly prepared. They were already a 6 in some bracketologies, you look for what those are worth. And I think that would have firmly put them on a 6 line, chasing something even higher. So they didn't lose anything there. The Nebraska game would have been the one that goes that's one that hurts you a little bit. Not a ton, because Nebraska's not awful this year, and it's a road game in terms of quad and all that stuff. But I still think that this team, the way they're playing right now, the way their capabilities of hitting shots, their capabilities of not overwhelming you offensively, and I think the addition of Jaden Akins to that scoring pool, with two centers who, granted, had a favorable matchup against Nebraska and hasn't had the worst of matchups lately, have sort of figured out who they are to this team. We're getting the best version of Mati Sissoko. That's not a great player, but it's a guy who's playing athletically. He's not lost his confidence, because that used to happen. He'd lose his confidence. He wouldn't be the athlete he is. He wouldn't go up after things. He wouldn't be on the floor. He sort of, I think, had a second wind here. The staff, I believe, has figured out how to quickly judge those centers against certain matchups when certain don't work. Like against Iowa, Rabracha was just
torching him over and over again.
Yeah, Kohler had no shot, and they couldn't play him. But they realized it, and after four buckets, that's it. And Kohler didn't play, and so they know that's going to happen in certain games, and they're sort of ready for it. So I do think that they're at a place where they sort of understand, you know, they're able to recognize it pretty quickly. So I think this is.
I'll tell you this: I think it's just such a different dynamic of problems that Izzo's had to deal with. I don't think you've seen him have the kind of problems in the paint like that. Where you're just that depleted that you have to work around that, and have as much offense around that black hole in the paint. Right? I mean, it's fascinating because usually it's inside out, right? This is an outside in team.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you see it when Hogard gets to the basket, then you start to see the Kohler and Sissoko offensive abilities a little more because there's more eyes focused on AJ Hogard than there are in the other two, and he's got good vision to get them the ball. But that's been a problem as well, but you know, the keeping Hogard consistent like that, because I think that's something they identified as well, is when he gets, you know, downhill into the paint, that helps offset some of the offensive liabilities that they have at the five.
No, I think that, you know, I do think that the fact that they don't have guys who go in prolonged slumps. Like Joey Hauser, when he, you know, a year ago, he missed some shots and he just sort of disappear, where he'd have two or three games. Like, he can have a game where he's off, but he keeps shooting. And Tyson Walker's probably been the most consistent of those shooters. Akins looks like he's with supreme confidence. Hall, even though he's not, you know, I think he's sort of accepted what he's going to be this year, is still, I mean, he hit shots in the last game that were big, big, important shots. What they need, though, is Hogard to be, you know, it's a single elimination world in college basketball, and they can't afford too many missteps from him. But if he's really good, they become a tough out. Let's talk about,
you know, before we jump with that, you mentioned about Hall being what he is. What's coincided with those 80 to 100 point games that they've had? It's Malik Hall scoring in double digits the last four. That's a big piece that they have not had. And, you know, again, with him and Akins, you know, you've got guys who can create from the wing. And, you know, if Hall can, you know, continue to build on the consistency, and I think that's been his issue, you know, since coming back the second time, if he can continue to do that, that allows everybody else. I mean, because he's the fourth scorer, right? I mean, you got the other three with Walker, Hauser, and Akins. Now Malik Hall can become who early in the year was a primary scorer. I mean, that's a heck of a four option right there to give you some offensive firepower.
Well, I think when he first came back, he was thinking, I've got to return to be that guy. And now he's sort of fitting in the offense and taking it as they come. And he feels like they've got enough. This spins to the next thing. I mean, I think he's coming back, and I've always thought he's coming back, and I know he's walking as part of senior day ceremonies and everything. But like, I think he's coming back, which I think is huge for next year's team, because he's the sort of veteran. He's better than a glue player, but you know what I mean? Glue piece in that four spot with a lot of young guys at other spots, potentially, and some veterans as well. But I think he's coming back. What makes this
a solid leader.
Yeah. What makes this an interesting senior day is that outside of Joey Hauser, who's actually not walking because he did a year ago, and I don't think Hauser's coming back, but he has the option.
He would have to apply for
some stuff. Right. But he's not.
It would surprise me if he came back, but he does have the option to get that year back when he left high school early, because he was hurt his senior year in high school and early enrolled in, which you don't usually see in college basketball, but he enrolled in January, and because he was already out with an injury and just took advantage of the Marquette training and rehab program, which, you know, in a lot of ways is smart. And I believe he's already going to have his master's after this semester as well. So, you know, guys, that you get to that point, you know, unless you're going for a doctorate,
You know, he's the best NBA prospect on the team too. He's going to get a look. He may be a second round pick. Yeah. I mean, he's a guy who fits the NBA, because what you want to be in the NBA is a master of something and not a jack of all trades. You don't want to, I mean, Malik Hall's biggest problem, other than his limited size, is he's got a great array of skills, and he's been injured, and he hasn't developed anything truly, truly consistently to, but you know, you're better off at the next level being Bryn Forbes, that does one thing incredibly well and hit shots. And does the other things well enough to hang on the court. And Hauser as a shooter, you know, has a chance. I think his brother being in the league will make people, you know, give him a look. And just from what I've heard, he's going to get a look. And I don't think he's planning to come back. Except this has been a great senior year. Sometimes it's sort of like Xavier Tillman as a junior. You have your moment in college basketball. He has been really good stemming from the end of last year. He's sort of changed his whole story arc at Michigan State. I think, you know, this is it's a good time. And there's, you know, teams have to change year to year too. And now I know they're bringing in enough new guys that it would. And frankly, here's the other thing. Everybody talks about, oh, they should have added an extra transfer. And maybe they could have with a one-year guy, 1 year only. But if I don't believe Hauser could come back next year and Walker and Hall, I'd have to do the numbers. And they might be over the scholarship number if they did that. I think the only two of them could come back to fit under the scholarships if nobody else left or anything like that. Now, Walker, it's interesting. The fact that it's unclear with him, I've thought all along Hall's coming back. Chris, I'll buy you a pizza if he doesn't. Like, that's what I think. That's how much I think.
I don't need any more pizza after that one that we had in Iowa.
Okay, fair enough.
Shout out to Matt McQuaid.
Tyson Walker is the one who surprised me a little bit. And I think NIL probably has something to do with this for a couple of these guys. I think there's money that we don't really have a firm grasp of that these guys are making. But it is interesting because he's had a great year too. And he's had a year as a featured guy. And I don't know how much more there is for him to do at the college level. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's a wonderful player and helps Michigan State tremendously. I do think if he comes back, the dynamic gets, you know, I mean, if you have a Walker, Hogard, Akins trio, that's a hard trio to track. And Jeremy Fears Jr., I think, probably thinks he's a day one starter. I think people there thought he'd be a day one starter, probably playing him next to Hogard, even though he's a point guard. You don't have a freshman at point, and that's probably better in a Tom Izzo system. But that would be delicate politically, I think, to have to deal with that a little bit. I think that would be interesting to see how they would so I don't know if that'll play a role too in things. But Walker coming back, like, I mean, with the young players they have, and if Hall comes back, I think he would. That's all of a sudden that lineup next year, because it's this, you know, if you can get old in college basketball and get really old in ways you won't be able to in years to come because of the extra year, and then also have, you know, talented blue chippers coming in, that's as good as it gets.
Which I think is really interesting for the Hauser situation. Obviously, you know, you mentioned the NIL money. I mean, that's the thing, is if let's say that, you know, the scouts aren't totally enamored with him at the league, do you want to go take your chance of playing in the G League or go overseas, or do you come back and, you know, take the NIL money if it's enough, if there's enough there, and try and win a national title? Maybe. I mean, I think Jason Whitens is an interesting guy in that respect, because he's already had two medicals, and he's another guy that's going to walk as a senior, but he's got a chance to come back for a sixth year, 2 years out from his injury. And it's a guy that started at the MAC level. So, I mean, you know, you're not talking about a guy that's going to be a starter or even maybe a key rotation guy, but it's the depth, you know, it's a depth piece that they don't have this year that they can, you know, bankroll a little bit in moments that you need them for, you know, 2-3 minute stretches. So, and he would be 2 years out post-op from the latest injury, which would change how well he's played. But I think that, you know, think about that. I mean, you could have 2 6-year guys, you know, and 2 5th-year guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'd never seen that in college basketball. That's the opposite of the one and done. It's the complete opposite of what one and done was like for so long. And I think college coaches have, I don't want to say embraced that, but I think they see the benefits of maximizing what those COVID years have done to enhance age, size, strength, you know, that you can't get with the one and dones.
Well, and even, you know, even once this 5-year deal is over in a couple of years where guys no longer will have that option, I think the book is out that it's better to be older in college basketball, as it was mostly throughout time. Although there have been some years where the one and done generation of real top end guys helped drive some national championships, but it's been a while since that's happened. And the one time transfer rule, you get a lot of veterans moving to teams, and but I do think Michigan State's in a spot where almost ideal at the time of this extra year, where you have a lot of really good college players who aren't great pro prospects. And that's ideal for winning. And, you know, like Cassius Winston, best example of this ever. Who would you rather have? 2 years of Miles Bridges, 4 years of Cassius Winston? Cassius Winston. Like, when you are recruiting in college basketball, Cassius Winston is the ideal recruit, not Miles Bridges. And so that is the thing you have to remember. This isn't the NBA. This is and so I do think that all that stuff's like, I think there's almost no chance Hauser's back, but I do think Whiten's, they're going to have a lot more depth next year. So he'd probably have even less of a chance of having a role. Although there's usually a guy like him when they're in their tournament out in Thanksgiving somewhere, Portland, yeah, or wherever it is, that has a big weekend.
Those are important minutes if you get them, you know? I mean, because, you know, if you've got an experienced guy that can do that versus, say a sophomore walk-on, I mean, that's a significant difference. You know, I mean, think about Kenny Goins for a minute. You know, remember when they were depleted at center that year, you know, they played an undersized 6'6 guy, and I think he got 14 rebounds at Louisville, maybe. Was it that game that he kind of came in and everyone was like, what, where'd this guy come from? So, I mean, sometimes you can catch lightning in a bottle, but sometimes it's just simply that you need an extra body that can be serviceable for however many minutes it is, 2, 3, 5, not every game, you know, in spot situations. So
if Jason Whiten's is lightning in a bottle, I will buy you another pizza.
Wouldn't it be something if the 6th-year guy comes in and all of a sudden scores like 16 a game?
It would be something. It would
not happen, but
better chance.
Know, that's your dream sequence, right? I mean, you come back for your 23rd year, for your final year of eligibility, and you use your old man game to light it up.
Equal chance that I run a marathon tomorrow. but it's just while eating a donut, which the second part is actually probably more likely.
That would be an incredible athletic feat all the way around.
Yeah. Hanging on to the same donut for 26 miles. So that's going to be an interesting story to watch here. And it comes front and center because it's senior day and people are going to start wondering. And you detailed this and I think it's,
And you detailed that Stephen Izzo is coming back. Speaking of walk-ons who might be lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, there's another. Yeah, he's that lines up with his master's degree program too, with one more year. So that fits him. Ohio State.
I will say that's actually a great point, and I gotta make this a point abundantly clear because I think it's fantastic to see guys taking advantage of extra years and staying in school and doing those things and getting extra degrees. I think that's, you know, if there's anything that the COVID year helps with, I think that's fantastic because these guys can now get a year of college. Stephen Izzo is obviously on Tom Izzo plan, so it's a little different, but you know, guys like Malik Hall and Joey Hauser, you know, they're going, and Jason Whiten's, they're getting their master's degree. I mean, you know, 5-6 years ago, guys weren't able to do that. And now it's a thing. And I mean, in the era of NIL and COVID extra years, that's, I think, one plus, I think, that's come out of it.
So Ohio State, last time they played them, obviously, Ohio State is a little different team. Zed Key's been shut down for the year.
Yeah.
That actually
is a big help for Michigan State.
And I do think I do think Ohio State is, look, they played well in the last game. The last two games, they won by double digits, both at home. So a team that I thought had given up and quit has not. And I think that's important for Ohio State. I still find it hard to believe they're going to come into Breslin. They've not looked like a team that's all that well connected. But they probably believe a little more than they have before. I think the key for Michigan State is to not let them find confidence, to not diddle around, to get out and have one of those home game starts where you get up 13-4 and you know the other team doesn't find the confidence and belief, because we've seen Ohio State teams over the years give Michigan State problems in this last game that's often at Breslin. We've seen lesser teams in Michigan State at times have moments where all of a sudden they figure out they can play with them, and then it's a game. And so I think that's
especially really because spring break starts and students won't be there. That changes the dynamic sometimes in Breslin.
Well, and students will still be there for this, though. This is still a student ticket, right? The Saturday
game. I mean, it's still a student ticket, but if you got a spring break plans, odds are, especially after the past month, you're going to want to get the hell out.
Well, that's fair, because now you make me sound like a jerk for the point I was going to make. But if you have a season ticket, like people care about their team. They always say, well, you know, what do you do to help your team? If you are a student in the Izzone, now there will have enough people there to be packed. And you can't stick around until noon on Saturday to begin your spring break. And your team loses and the atmosphere stinks. You can't complain about your team the rest of the way. Like, stick it through Saturday. That said, I certainly understand if somebody wants to duck out. I think the crowd will be fine. I think it'll be but I used to, when I covered the MAC, by the way, and again, drink, when I used to have this debate all the time with, like, Central and Western had this issue where they would play these games late in the year on spring break week often, and it really impacted their crowd and their students. And I used to say, look, if you want to be a serious basketball league, a serious sports league, and they all did. They were chasing money in the MAC. So that stuff mattered. You're fighting an uphill battle. Fix your academic calendar, man. Like, it's pretty easy. Just do spring break a week later. Have it so they can travel to the conference tournament if they want to. Like, make that your spring break. Don't do it on the final
week. Well, but that's the thing, is that is next week, and they've got their spring break next week, but the kids get out of town on Friday, you know, when classes are done. No one's sticking around when they don't have classes.
That's a kid problem. Kids are stupid. What are you going to do? No, I'm kidding.
Speaking of the MAC, I wanted to throw this out there before we wrap. I don't know if you saw the Antoine Davis situation last night. He's challenging Pistol Pete's record, misses a three basically at the buzzer that would have tied it. But did you see the aftermath at Youngstown State?
Where I did not see it, no.
In the handshake line, there was a Youngstown State player who was chirping at him, and they had to drag Antoine Davis off the court. I mean, it was a bad look for the Youngstown State people. You know, Davis was obviously frustrated, and from what I understand, because there was close video from one of the Youngstown TV stations, the guy basically told him, he says, I should have been the player of the year, and bumped into him and shoulder bumped him. And then there was a lot of dragging, and the Youngstown State fans were throwing food from the stands and beer. It was a pretty ugly scene and weird way for that to kind of come to an end, unless somehow UAD gets like a CBI invite, which
could happen, because the CBI, the thing is, the CBI is not a merit-based tournament. It is a complete pay your way in. And so if Detroit decides they want him to have the Maravich record and the scoring record all time, they can pay their way in. He will be a good marketing tool.
And the tournament would have eyeballs for once.
Yeah. I learned that early on, that it's not those CBI and CIT are not merit-based. They are to some degree. You can't be 0-30, but what I mean is, you have to be willing to pay to host home games and all sorts of things. And they're not to that degree. They probably shouldn't count for things. I'm a little torn on it because, you know, Davis did it in two more years, or is doing it in two more years of marriage with a 3-point line. Like, it's like, I don't know that that it should actually be broken.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people forget about the fact that he was a freshman. I think I saw something like Maravich. If you throw in Maravich's freshman team stats, he wouldn't have come close. It was like 470 more points.
So am I the only basketball nerd junkie, though? Like, I we go back to what we said before. The kids get out of town. I know they go to Fort Lauderdale, you know, whatever they do. But like to me, is there a better road trip week? Like, I can't imagine enjoying something more than a conference tournament on spring break. Like, how awesome that would be. Like, you got the week off. I'm going to go watch my school play, and I'm going to sit around and watch hoops in a cool town. And, like, that to me is – I understand people to get warm. I got to imagine that's appealing for some kids. If I'm missing that, like, I can't – if I'm standing around all year at the – and I'm invested in my team to get there early, to be in the Izzone, to do all that, wouldn't I think Chicago, the first week of March, second week of March, watching a bunch of hoops would be amazing. I mean, I don't know. There's that's that's
well, my 25 own. Years ago, as a matter of fact, I did go to Chicago in spring break 1998.
There you go. So I'm in St. Louis, Minnesota. Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, obviously Chicago is a different thing. I mean, you know, I think a lot of it depends if you've got a free place to stay. You know, college kids, you know, the income level has changed maybe a little bit more in the last 25 years, family income level and, you know, individual stuff, you know, whether it be credit cards or whatever else, kids seem to have more of things these days to allow them to bankroll stuff like that.
But based on the number of kids who Uber to class with Phil Friend, they certainly have more resources than they used to. So
drink at home if you have the Phil Friend reference on your bingo card.
All right. Well, we will be back next week, pre-Big Ten tournament, to talk about that and where Michigan State is and take another snapshot of the postseason. And we'll have coverage, obviously, from Sunday's game against Ohio State. For Chris Solari and the Detroit Free Press, for myself, the Lansing State Journal, for USA Today Network, and for our silent partner, Phil Friend, we appreciate you. Rate, subscribe, whatever they say you do there with this podcast. If you like it, throw fruit. If you don't, and we will talk to you next week.